any questions? Karen? Well, of what we have, well, you know, is memories. We have the memories of them. And so that means we want to do something with that. So generally, you know, I like to dedicate things, good actions, and in memory of my parents. Use my parents' memory as a catalyst for good things. It's like honoring them, because I don't know, you know, what happens when they're, you know, what it is now. But it does affect the present in terms of my own experience. So, and this I can, you know, I can see for myself. So then I find it, you know, kind of beautiful custom in Buddhist countries. They're, you know, some, like in the meals, people come and offer dana, and then they're in memory of my father, mother, and things like this. And this is a kind of way of honoring, using their memory to contribute good things into the society. And then also just reflecting on, you know, the benefit, the goodness of your own life you're sharing with them. And that has a good effect, you know, because, you know, I feel, well, my parents died years ago, but, you know, just, well, I still remember, and I still, you know, think of them. So it's, may the blessings of my life be a benefit to my parents. Whatever happens, I don't know. But it does feel good when I say that. You know, it's a joyful kind of beautiful thought. And then when we recognize that, then it's, you know, we're affecting everything, you know, around us. You know, our joy and our happiness has its effect on people we live with and contact. It spreads us outwards. So like in Buddhism, you always, you know, you now the memory, you know, of your, like memory of my parents is now that they're both dead rather than alive. So then that puts a kind of finality to, you know, I don't know what that is because I haven't died myself, but I do feel this gratitude to them, and even the problems I had with them don't seem so important to me. Because basically the more positive memories dominate. And then also, like, the an expression of gratitude is to, like, dedicate the goodness of your life in memory of your parents. These are skillful ways of just thinking and of brightening your mind. My mother and father, they were not Buddhist, and they were not arahants or anything. So I'm sure my mother went to some heavenly realm somewhere. If she went to a hell realm, that would be that would be really unfair. But I don't know, you know, the reality of it. Are your parents still alive or no? No, I've tried to. I find, you know, like in here in England also, people. Like, I think English people like this very much because most of us don't know what to do when somebody's dead. You know, maybe take a bouquet of flowers or plant a lily on the grave or something. But it's pretty. You know, there's not a real kind of sense for this in our society. We tend to dismiss death, almost like get it over with, and then maybe once in a while go visit the grave and pull the weeds out. But there's not this kind of more active style of honoring the memory. Like people plant trees, a lot of the trees are planted in memory of various people who have died, and offering food to the Sangha or helping the poor, whatever. It could be any, you know, some kind of a compassionate action that we do, and then say, and may the blessings, and may the blessings of this in memory of my parents. Any more questions? Right. Yeah. Are you on speaking terms and all that, or? Yeah, well, just notice, you know, the fact that you're, when I talk this way, that this is the way you're feeling. So it's just more or less, you know, to trust that more, to not to try to, you know, think about it too much, but just notice that when I say feel gratitude to your parents, and then that, what does that, and then what comes up in your consciousness? And then the direct way is just to notice it's like this, you know, whatever it is, whatever memories or feelings or doubts or whatever rise, trust in that. Because that's the very direct way. Because like a couple came up after the talk finished, and they were, you know, the woman had the idea you had to control, you know, you had to make your mind pure. Meditation was making your mind pure, and she wanted to know, was this about the right way of looking at it? And so, you know, and then I was reflecting to her that if you're trying to make your mind pure, you know, as an act of will, then you're going to be terribly disappointed, because that's not how it works. You know, it's not. What do you mean by pure? And then she said, well, no bad thoughts. And so then point out how thinking, you know, can make good thoughts and bad thoughts arise. You know, you cannot have just good thoughts. You know, if you've got good and bad are connected in some way, you know, the two sides of the coin. So it's not a matter of thought, but recognizing your mind, basically your pure, your true nature is pure already. It's like it's never, no matter the most maniacal evil thoughts cannot stain your true nature. You know, but so then, and this is for reflection, you know, then so purity isn't something you get through trying to get rid of the bad, but beginning to recognize the purity, the basic purity of that you begin to recognize through awareness, because that's pure. You know, awareness is pure, and this is. I mean, I'm not asking you to believe this, but you know, put it to the test. You know, begin to know the difference of awareness and thinking. Like thoughts come and go, or moods or emotions come and go. The awareness, you know, is pure, because if angry thought comes, the awareness isn't angry. But if you think you're the anger, then you grasp the anger and then you become an angry person. But if you begin to really notice that awareness, it doesn't get angry, it isn't greedy, it isn't deluded. Pure. So you're actually, what the Buddha's asking us to do is just to start in the, to recognize the true nature of our purity is through this awareness, is the door, the gate to that. Then our perspective on the good and bad, pleasant and painful feelings and thoughts are seen, no longer identifying with. You're no longer ignorant, so you're no longer identifying yourself with your emotional habits or memories or thoughts. So then in terms of your individual life as a human being living in society, then you see the joy of doing good and the pain and the joy of and the happiness that peacefulness that comes from refrain from doing, acting on evil impulses. So like, you know, I can understand evil because I see that potential. You know, So, like say, in seeking revenge, somebody kills my mother. And then I can understand the desire to kill the person that killed my mother. But I can also step back from that and realize I'm not going to do that. You know, on the moral level, I'm not going to kill. So then that helps to stop, to reflect this desire to get even, seek revenge. But anyone can see that this is just a condition that arises and ceases. So then the relationship to the murderer is more from compassion rather than from, which is, you know, comes through understanding and seeing the pain and the misery of humanity, and that the killer is a human being just like ourselves, and that to kill somebody is, you know, creates a lot of pain and fear in that person. So after reflecting like this, you know, I thought, you know, I'd rather die than kill somebody. You know, because even if I killed somebody and got away with it, was never punished for it, I'd have to live with that. You know, that has a powerful, a very strong memory. Very powerful memory. If I lived to 100 years, I'd have that haunting me like a phantom, like the Furies. So then I'd rather be killed than kill. So, because I'm going to die sometime. You know, it's just a matter of time, really. But to me, it'd be like a living death, living with all these memories of having killed somebody. And the fear and the paranoia that comes out of that. Yeah. Well, that's why people like that have to usually drink a lot, or, you know, constantly on the move, and yeah, they have distraction. As soon as you're alone, you know, the worst thing for that is to be left alone with nothing to do. There was years ago in Vientiane in Laos, I visited a meditation monastery. This was before Laos went communist, and so there was a lot of, you know, the Royal Army, Lao Army, had been fighting the communists and so forth. So in this meditation monastery, there was one monk, newly ordained monk, who'd been a soldier in the Royal Army, and he'd killed a lot of people, you know, as a soldier in battles, communists. And then he left the army and became a monk, and one of the monks took me to see him, and he was living in a little hut by himself, you know, quite secluded. And then he said he's just living in hell all the time because all these memories, you know, just overwhelming him, the fear, memories of the people he'd killed, and they just, you know, and of course, if he stays with it and trusts in awareness, he can actually liberate himself from that. But it's like being in hell, literally. It must be for him. He looked like a hell being. And I don't think he stayed. The monk that was with me said they don't usually last too long. It's too painful. But I notice, you know, in my life, I haven't done anything that bad. It's still pretty, sometimes, you know, you know, in the beginning stages especially, pretty hard to stay with some of the, you know, when you're just alone with yourself and these kind of repressed emotions start coming up. You do anything to distract yourself or get away from it. Yeah, well, then it's like using the present, like being more. That's why you know, if you think about them, then you kind of get caught into them, and you go around thinking the same thoughts over and over. But so go more toward the. What I do is I'm aware of the body, the energy in the body. I go to the sound of silence, stop the thinking. So I stop thinking about them or trying to figure out or judge or do that. And then just being aware of the mood and this feeling of that's left, what's remaining. Because like the thought will maybe, you know, goes very quickly and then, but then the emotion lingers, the energy of the emotion is still there. And if you don't, and if you keep thinking about it, then you'll start, that lingering energy will start you thinking the thoughts that will keep reinforcing the, creating the energy. But if you recognize that just stop thinking, and that's through paying attention to the feeling in the body, that the feeling of, say, that you have in your here or here, in the trunk of your body. It's just and with this attitude of receiving and allowing it rather than having to do anything with it. Then you'll probably notice it's changing this and you know, it's fading. Where you actually, through that, have the realization of cessation, because when it's gone. And, you know, and sometimes it's such a, you know, you really, it's gone, where did it go? You know, and then this is, and you really realize it's quite a blissful state when you let something just go its natural way without you kind of running into something else. You're just letting it be, it changes, it drops. And then this, what's left is bliss. This purity, and then you know, oh, this is what it is. but if you're always trying to get rid of it, then you'll never experience the cessation. You'll never know cessation. So you can spend the rest of your life resisting, fighting the demons. Yeah, you can, then, once you really see that, you can just, the memory can still arise, but you don't grasp it. You don't need to make anything of it. And, because memories you have. You know. But I've found now, through this practice, that you know, memories that used to really upset me don't bother me in the least anymore. Because I've resolved it. I still can remember, but it's where before the memory would, then I'd grasp the memory, then I'd get caught into the whole process, and I could feel just as angry 30 years later about it. That happened 30 years ago, and my brain is saying, oh, forget it, it was long ago, don't be so silly, you know, saying all these kind of things, you know, common sense. But you're still feeling it, you know, no matter what this is saying, you know, just let it go, it doesn't matter, forget it. But now you're not, you know, that kind of advice, you're recognizing that emotion isn't rational and common sense. It's not commonsensical. Emotions are like this, you know. And so even though your intellect can say, don't be so silly, this is ridiculous, let it go. Your emotions, if you've not resolved it on that emotional level, then they'll keep punching away at you till you pay attention and resolve them. But then, haven't you found out when you do that, it's relief rather than, you know, you realize there's nothing to fear, really. But before you know that, then you, oh God, if I let this in, you know, I'll be, you know, you can think, it'll take me over, or I'll be, get depressed, or, you know, you can imagine all kinds of terrible things that might be, but the actual result is peacefulness, bliss, rather than more misery. So then that'll give you the more faith. So then you're more confident when the next thing comes up. You know, you're more, because you've actually proved it to yourself. So you have a confidence, your faith increases. And then your wisdom increases. The saddha panya faculties are developing. Can you hear me, Rojana? Rojana is very happy today because she can never hear. She's got deaf problems, and she's got her hearing aid on the, what is it, the circuit. On the loop. You hear my heartbeat. Yeah, once you begin to realize how to deal with it, then of course, it'll manifest again in some way. But there are maybe subtleties in that. But then the more mindful you are, the more you are aware of the subtleties of, like, movement of thought and energy and emotion. And then, you become, the more you trust in your awareness of that, then mindfulness connects. It's like a very strong receptacle for experience. So you become more sensitive, but more wisdom is involved. And so you're not, sensitivity isn't something that's just, making endless problems around life. You know, like some people that are sensitive, are so frightened of things because they feel everything too much. Well, with this, it gives you receptacle, a kind of like a refuge for being human, for being who you are, and whatever that involves, and whatever karma that might manifest. And then we all have periods of, in our life where I've had experience in my life where everything seems going along really, feel nothing much happening in the mind, perfectly calm, then something will happen, something sometimes out of the blue that is quite shocking or incredibly disappointing, or brings up emotions that I may not have felt for years. So then the wisdom faculties develop. So if you think, well, as soon as you claim, oh, I've conquered all these things, they're no problem to me anymore. Oh, then I'm in for a good bashing the next moment. That's happened quite a few times where I've congratulated myself and anger's not much of a problem for me anymore. Then something will happen and then I'll be quite angry. So I don't congratulate myself, but just work with this idea of dependent origination. When the conditions arise, then this is the result. So in your own life experience, as you experience life, because we all have to grow old and deal with the loss of relatives and parents and things like this, and disease and sickness and so forth, and so these affect, our mind. So our relationship to those experiences is through awareness and understanding, rather than just taking it all personally or resenting the fact of having an ailment or getting old or people you love disappearing and things like this. You have a way of learning and strengthening yourself through all these trials. So, like just every time a monk or nun disrobes, it's like grief. But it's not something that I wallow in or that ruins my life or I'm going to get lost in, but you feel it, the grief of someone giving up the holy life is like this. In terms of way I experience it, so, and at first it used to, it would be too shocking, and I'd get lost in the kind of proliferations around it. Then just keep trusting in this awareness, so that now there's a strength in that, in this its receptacle of awareness is very powerful. And then you're more aware of just subtle energetic movements and or blockages in your own system, in your own body. Because, you know, the body is affected by life, so you get shocks and you get traumas and things like this is part of human experience. And of course, the modern society is one that, you know, you try to get on with things. A lot of grief or that is never resolved in people very well. Because you just get on to the next thing, and then it comes up at other times in your life. So this attitude of welcoming, you know, that as we learn, as we, you know, we live our lifespan, we keep learning from it, and we feel stronger and confident in that. Because you're beginning to recognize your true nature, which is not mortal and not your body, not your emotional habits or your thoughts or your personality. You know, and it's a oneness. We're the same in that. We're not two. And then in the thought process, the sense world, we separate. You know, so that we create division through consciousness, rather than abiding in the oneness of consciousness. So if I'm here and you're there, we're two separate people, and that's on the conventional level. But that's a creation. I'm thinking that, and that's the way it seems according to like I consciousness. But when we get to a pure awareness, that awareness isn't, that purity is our union, you know, that purity of awareness. But then when we think and get attached to our feelings, then we create the divisions. We begin to see, you know, with all humans, all beings really, the what you're recognizing a oneness, and then from there once you realize that, then you can see how you divide it, and through this not understanding things we live in a world of division and separation and likes and dislikes and fear and whatnot, and then we create wars, and it's interesting time where, you know, we don't seem to learn, you know, the very well, you know, the war seems to be such a kind of innate tendency in human beings. You know, if you don't like it, kill it. Or that over there is our enemy. Seeing anything that doesn't quite fit into your allowance is regarded as an enemy. And then, so that's always limiting us to we become rigid and deadened by those attachments. Now, once you see that, then the common humanity we share. So then we find we're no longer seeing each other through the differences or through the fears or opinions we have, but through the commonality of our humanity. And then in consciousness, as we begin to recognize or realize, then the unity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like that's the power of when we you know, in the, that's what we can do as citizens, is to let it be known, to join in with that which is wholesome and good and benevolent, as an active way we relate to the society. That Iraq war seems to just get so, everything so confused, right? Yes? Well, it says, but whoever initiates and instills and inculcates the qualities of faith in parents that are lacking in faith, morality in parents of poor morals, liberality in parents stingy in giving, and wisdom in parents deficient in wisdom, such a one has repaid, sufficiently repaid and amply repaid the debt of gratitude to his parents. Well, I mean, that's what we're doing, actually, you know. But by you doing it, then it's going to affect your parents. And I've seen a lot of, you know, parents, you know, they, with what Westerners, especially when, because of parents usually, you know, very much are very shocked and oftentimes against their sons or daughters becoming Buddhists, Buddhist monks or nuns. And I've seen it where some monks, their parents have even forbidden them to come home, to go home, because they don't want the neighbors to see them, or don't want them to wear robes when they go home, that they're ashamed of them, and things like this. You get some very strong reactions, and yet many times parents benefit from our lives as monks and nuns. Because, you know, because it'd be wrong if we were becoming Buddhist monks or nuns in order to shock our parents. You know, that would be just malice. But if our parents get shocked because of our own good intentions, then maybe that's something they need to learn from. Maybe that shock is good for them. I'm just speculating. Because it has shakes them out of the kind, you know, you can get into a kind of into a rut in your own life where you just see things in a certain way, and you're afraid of everything, that you just want everything to kind of protect your own small world view. And then something shocking happens and you have to accept something that you've never had to deal with before. And we all, you know, those are really important experiences for us in life, where we've had to grow or expand and include things that before we would have rejected or ignored. Like being in Amaravati, you know, say on a personal level, when I as a personality, I have very limited, you know, who I like, who I want to be with, only, you know, I have very, you know, certain small ideas around this, who I want to be with. And then as a Buddhist monk, head of a community in Amaravati, that's not a not a personal choice, you're accepting those who want to be here in order to practice. So it's not a matter of my personally liking or whatever, but it's a matter of their intention. So I've had to expand, I've had to include, I've had to grow through necessity. And I found that, you know, painful, but also very, you know, it gives me much more joy and freedom to have, be expansive rather than just into this controlling narrow margins of what I've determined is I can only take. Because I found out, you know, when I have I can stand so much more than I think I can. You know, I know I can take all kinds of things now. I'm not this precious person I used to be that, well, if it goes beyond this, I'll just fall apart. I mean, I can keep expanding. And so challenges, I learn from the monks and nuns. You know, from their goodness or their practice. So in their, when they develop their generosity, their morality, their wisdom, then has a good effect on me. So you see, I'm in kind of a parent role here. Then their growth and their wisdom, their compassion, has a good effect on me. So we're affecting each other, you know, and it's not just a one-way situation. And then many times I've seen it where, because when monasticism, you're actually you know, you're dealing with subjects like death a lot, on age and pain and all the side of life that modern hedonistic world wants to get away from. You know, so like death or loss or getting a terminal ailment or something like this. Now we deal with that a lot, you know. So, like for us, we have a skeleton in the chapel in back, and we've even had, when people have died, we've brought in their corpses and meditated on people that have died in England, who we can, you know, they let us keep the body for a week or so. And so we're quite willing to look into this side of life, quite, you know, to really learn from it. So when your friends or your parents or relatives go through these experiences, we oftentimes can be great help, great support for them, because sometimes our parents have not prepared themselves at all for their death, or our friends or relatives, you know, may have lived their lives, you know, just avoiding that. And so you find many people coming here, you know, needing that kind of help, you know, how to deal with loss or with the fact that you've got a terminal ailment or with pain and disease and separation from the loved and all these things, you know, because we're looking at these in quite a realistic and direct way. Our people sense this, and then they can, and we're quite willing to share what we know with them. So I've seen many monks and nuns able to really be of great help to their mothers and fathers at a time when, who may have one time, you know, been very angry with them for becoming Buddhist samanas. There's not many people in the society willing to talk about death. You know, so, you know, you've been to hospices and people that deal with this, taking care of the dying, and this is a subject that, you know, people don't want to kind of, I mean, it's frightening and they don't know what to say. And dying people, many of them are quite eager to discuss death. They want to understand it because they know they're dying. And then people come in and talk about the weather and, you know, football and things like this. And they could care less about that if that's the... But the, you know, what's really important is that people are too frightened to talk about. But because of, you know, of the, our, we, you know, because we address these things, we reflect on old age, sickness and death, you know, as a part of monastic life, then you have an understanding that most people don't have on those subjects. And yet, this is life. We're all going to, you know, we all get old and have sicknesses and we'll die. It's the natural flow. It's so part of a human experience. You know, rather surprising when you think of it, how that side of life has been like, don't want to know the really important things of life you think are sick or morbid or depressing. They're not. They're not at all if you see them with wisdom rather than with some kind of morbid fascination. I've seen, like here, sometimes people will, somebody like from the British side, somebody will, there'll be a death in a family, and the person that died will be a Buddhist, and he or she's asked for some kind of Buddhist funeral. So then we have one here, and all their relatives and friends come. And so then we have, sometimes we do these where we have, give people a chance to stand up and express their feelings about the person that died, and then they'll always ask me to say something about it. So I reflect in the Buddhist way around death, like that it's natural, it's part of nature, there's nothing to fear, nothing wrong with it. Let's say the most kind of obvious thing. And recognizing that all our lives are impermanent, we're all going to realize death sometime in our, you know, at the end of our lives, this will be our last, you know, conscious recognition. And then people have come up and said, that was really helpful, you know. And I thought I was just saying something kind of commonplace. You know, you live... This is quite ordinary for us. But some people never even thought of death as natural, as, you know, as just a normal thing that happens, and that we're all going to experience it. They've never made the connection. You know, it's surprising. And I think it's something wrong or something bad, or why should it happen to my 99-year-old mother? It's not fair. Yeah, amazing. Well, I think I'll... Well, just to, you know them, so. You have to just trust your intuition. And be willing to, you know, one thing parents like very much is to know that you love them. And that sometimes we don't bother to say that. And then that that's quite nice to know. And then as you kind of, you know, like I found with my parents, as I expressed my gratitude to them, like when I went back for the first time as a Buddhist monk, I expressed my gratitude. And they were so moved by that. You know, they were so touched by the fact that I had gratitude and appreciated them, that just seemed to open doors that were never opened before. Because when I left, you know, I was away for about 13 years before I went back, then I'd been quite critical of them, and I'd lived away from them, and I hadn't really developed a really adult relationship with them. So, and because I'd been away for 13 years, then I hadn't seen them for, I'd written letters and that, but the real contact, one-to-one, that happened, and they were so glad to see me after 13 years absence that I don't think they would have cared what I was. If I was a naked ascetic, they probably would have been glad to and then when I expressed my gratitude to them, they were very moved, because I didn't think they were expecting that. And I didn't, you know, go and kind of preach at them about Buddhism or anything. I wasn't going to try to convert them or to impose Buddhism onto them. So if they'd ask questions, I'd answer, but I wasn't kind of, you know, trying to get them to meditate or anything, but more or less just creating an atmosphere of friendliness and warmth with them. And then, of course, my mother was more, because she had a strong kind of mystical streak, then when I talked to her, I had to learn the Buddhist terms didn't make any sense to her. So I started using Christian terms. This is interesting. Because I began to be more confident in using Christian terms in a way that, you know, from what I'd learned through Buddhism. And she found that, she liked that, you know, because it was, I'd learned the child's version of Christianity, you know, brought up in the kind of Christian atmosphere that's quite meaningful when you're young, when you're a child, and then it doesn't go on from there. So if you when you grow up, it doesn't make sense anymore. And my mother, having this mystical streak, had a much more kind of universal way of looking at things than just the childhood version of God up in the sky loving us and feeling sad when we are naughty. And then there was more, sense of being able to discuss things. But I noticed if I used Buddhist terminologies, it is too old to have much malleability on that level. So I had to learn to speak Christian, as you can do. You know, suddenly, because you're getting beyond the words themselves, and then you realize words are not fixed in, you know, how you define them and all that is something else. And then also through Buddhism, I began to understand how Christianity worked. You know, I began to see what that was, you know, I began to appreciate that, which I totally dismissed when I was just trying to see Christianity from a mind that saw things in critical ways and was, you know, educated to be reasonable and logical and scientific and then judged things with that kind of mindset. And then Christianity, as I had been taught it, sounded rather childish and backward. But then in Buddhism, because it's a psychological teaching in itself. Buddha was, you know, psychological terms, and then how to use those terms in a way that makes sense in a Christian, with Christian terminology and symbols, that you can do that. So when to me there's not a great problem about religious differences, because I can see, you know, there's different ways of looking at something. You can look at the point in the center from the north or the south or the east or the west. The point you're looking at is in the middle. The position you take is really, you know, happen to be where you are, you know. And where, when we get fixed in our own viewpoint, then we say, my position, only from the east can you see the true central point. You know. And the north, west, and south, they're heretics. That means I haven't seen the center point. I mean, it's merely blinded myself with my Eastern perceptions. So I'm feeling restless. Do you want to see me?